In a group of this size, I'm guessing that we have a few sports fans here and there scattered among us. I would imagine that's the case because I do hear some sports chatter once in a while, which is fine. We need to, it's sort of, they say, what is it, the candy department of life, because it, I guess, distracts us from the more important things and takes our mind off some of the things that maybe at some points a little more serious and depressing and so forth, or at least a little more, need a little more of our attention. This gives us an outlet away from that sometimes. With that being said, I wanted to tell you about a game. This particular game was a girls' basketball game, and it wasn't just any game, but it wasn't the game. It was the game that led up to the game. If they won this game, and they were in the state tournament, if they won this game, they were going to go to play for the title of state champions in their division in their particular state. It was a tough game because they had been favored to win, and as I said, it was girls' high school basketball. They'd been favored to win last year's game or the previous year's game, and they got to the very first game and they were soundly beaten, and it discouraged them, it bothered them, it caused them grief, it caused them to reevaluate what they were doing. And in doing that, they made the commitment and decided this is not going to happen to us again. If we ever get this opportunity again, we're going to take advantage of it. And they didn't lose a lot of their players from the previous year. They lost, as is always the case, a few of their players, but none of their most important ones. The core group of players was still in place, still together, and they wanted to take advantage of this because after this, they were going to be scattered to the wind, going to all kinds of colleges and so on, because a lot of them were seniors by this time. Now we're going to, for the purpose of this story and for this message, we're going to call these girls our team, and the other team will be their team. So we'll just say our and their, and we'll use that as the description for this. Their team was a bigger, stronger team, the one they were facing. They had made it all the way through the tournament and the year and the tournament, and it had gotten to this game. As I said, it wasn't the game, but it was the one that led up to the game. So there was one game. If they won this one, they were playing for the state championship. So, as I mentioned, their team was bigger and stronger than our team was. The whole game, they played hard, but for some reason they just couldn't. It took them a little while to get used to these big girls with these long arms that were in their face and guarding them, and they had difficulty getting that done, difficulty scoring, difficulty figuring out how to cope with all this, as can be expected. But by sometime close to the fourth quarter, they started to catch up and started to make a game out of this. And as they went closer and closer, they got closer and closer. And by somewhere in the fourth quarter, they tied it, and they actually ended up going ahead. So, as usually is the case in the last couple minutes of a basketball game, and I'm not a real big basketball follower, a real big basketball fan, and don't know all the ins and outs of basketball games, but I do know this: in the last couple of minutes, the losing team, if it's a reasonably close game, the losing team will be fouling the leading team. Those who are behind will start fouling them, and they'll have to go to the free throw line and try to make their free throw shots, which is what happened here. They were ahead by a few points, and our team was a very good free throw shooting team. They got up to the line, and when you know it, in the last 2 minutes, for the life of them, they could not make foul shots. They were there and they kept missing, hitting the rim and bouncing off and whatever happens when you're shooting free throws, but they couldn't make them. And the next thing you know, with 7 seconds left, the other team, their team, tied the game. The game was on the line. 7 seconds left. Now, normally, in that position, the coach would call a timeout. They'd regroup, and they'd try to get a little bit of a strategy together on what can we do here, or should we play for overtime, or how do we want to handle this. But the coach, in the previous timeout, before the other team had tied the game, had already set up a play, said, we're not going to take a timeout. We're going to take the ball and advance it up the court. And he had a strategy. He had a plan. So with 7 seconds left, normally the point guard would take the ball, advance the ball up the field, or up the court, rather. They don't play on a field in basketball. But well, sometimes maybe they might have, but normally the point guard would take up the ball up because they're usually the best ball handler, but the point guard here was also one of the best shooters, so he had the off guard advance the ball, and they just as soon as the other team tied the game, they took off. They did not want to go into overtime. The other team, as I mentioned, their team was bigger and stronger, and they had worn our team down. They were tired. They did not think that they could win a game in overtime because they were wore out. They were almost had expended most of their strength through the whole game just to defend these bigger girls. So they were going to try and win it right now. They advanced the ball up the court with the guard. The guard took off for the basket like she was going to drive to the basket. She drew three defenders in with her. She turned and flipped the ball back to the point guard, who was a very good shooter. And the point guard shot the ball. And just as it had left her hand, the buzzer rang. And the game was over. But as you know, once it leaves the hand of this person, the shooter, and it's in the air, whatever happens, that's what's going to stand. If she makes the basket, that's fine. If she doesn't, then whatever the consequences are, that's also fine. That's how it stands. Well, she shot the ball, and it was nothing but net. She made the three-point shot, and they won the game. The next game was almost an afterthought. They sort of blew out the next game and won the state title. The title of my message today is Nothing But Net. The reason for that is this girl who had made that shot, it didn't happen in a vacuum. It did not happen without a lot of effort. Now I want to turn back to Esther, the fourth chapter. Esther 4, this wasn't just all about sports, by the way. Esther chapter 4, and we'll get back to Esther a little later and get into the story of Esther a little bit. But in the meantime, we're going to just look at this one particular verse. And this girl, this point guard who took that shot, exemplified in her situation, in her position at that time, exemplified this, and I'll try to clarify this as we go along. In verse 14, Mordecai, and you might remember the story. Like I say, we'll rehearse the story a little bit later on. But Mordecai, who was Esther's, some think it was uncle, some think it was her cousin, relative at least. He said, "Who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" That girl was prepared for such a time as this. She had done her homework, and she had taken the time to prepare for that moment. As Esther here, as Mordecai said, "Who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" And that's what we're going to examine a little bit. Are we here, or do we ever find ourselves in a position like Esther did here, or like this point guard did, for such a time as this? In basketball, they call it 1,000 shots to make one. 1,000 shots to make one. And what that means is, well, we'll get into that here in just a second. These girls, as I mentioned, had lost last year or the year before, before they made this shot, had lost the previous year, and they rededicated themselves. They solidified what they could do and what they couldn't do. They went out and they made up their mind that we're not going to let this happen again. What did they do? They got up every morning at 5 o'clock in the morning, 5 a.m., and they went running. They did it every day. They ran and ran and ran. Every morning, 5 o'clock, they got up. And they didn't necessarily run at 5 o'clock, but they got ready to do whatever they had to do to prepare to get out there and run. They practiced every day. Every day in the gym, ball handling, ball control, different situations, all kinds of different things that they did to prepare for any particular given situation. Now, every one of these girls did not have the same talents. Some of them were good at ball handling. Some of them were good at shooting. Some of them were good at free throw shooting. Others were good at shooting from three-point range. Or others might have been good at doing layups and so forth under the basket, driving to the basket. But they weren't, and some of them were good at defending, getting the rebounds and so forth. And all of this was necessary in the framework of a game, in teamwork. It was all necessary so that they could perform at their peak. But they practiced all those things every day. They did 40 hours of ball handling. They did 40,000 shots, free throw shots. Not free throw shots, I'm sorry. Shots from all over the court. 40,000. That's another 40 hours. If you break it down, if you give it 3.5-4 seconds per shot, that's another 40 hours, just like they had been of ball handling. They had 125 one-on-one games that they practiced, each one of those girls, 125 hours, and that was all in the off season. That was all during the time when most of us would think, well, we can lay back, we can kick back, and we can take it easy because nothing's happening now. We don't have to worry. And I'll tell you a little anecdote that I heard one time. I used to be a big baseball follower and big baseball fan. I still like baseball, but not like I used to. And I was watching a game. I think it was a Sunday afternoon game on television. I forget who the announcer was or who was calling the game, but I do remember that Joe Morgan, who was a great second baseman for the Cincinnati Reds, most of you have heard of Joe Morgan, he was the color commentator, and the fellow that was calling the game was on the line. There were runners on base, and there was a guy at the plate, and if he got a hit, the game was going to be over, and the fellow that was calling the game mentioned how hard he's trying to get a hit. But Joe Morgan said, he said, the will to win is nothing without the will to prepare. And I thought that's always stood out in my mind, and I've always remembered that the will to win is nothing without the will to prepare. The will to get ready, the will to take the time to practice as these girls did and to put the time in and the effort. It's not easy getting up at, when you're a 17-year-old girl or guy or anybody, it's not easy getting up at 5 a.m. every morning just so you can prepare and get better prepared for what you're going to do. And it's not even today or tomorrow or whenever. It's down, way down the road. It's not right now. It's for the future. It's to prepare for the shot. It's to prepare for nothing but net. Paul even mentioned this in 1 Corinthians 9, and we may not think about this very much, but there were games going on during those times as well. There were something comparable, I guess, to what became the Olympic Games, and Paul actually in several places makes a reference to this, and in 1 Corinthians 9, he makes a specific reference to games or to sports. And in this case, it's running. In 1 Corinthians 9, and we'll start in verse 23, but sort of the lead up to that is Paul talking about the discipline or how he disciplines himself to do what he has to do, to bring the word of God to those, or the gospel to those who he's addressing. And he, here in this particular chapter, it's the chapter before chapter 11, which we normally go to for the Passover, which explains the Passover, but here he's leading up to that. And in chapter 9 of 1 Corinthians, in verse 22, he said, "To the weak, I became as weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, that I might by all means save some." The King James says, "save a few." That by all means save a few. "Now this I do," in verse 23, "for the gospel's sake, that I may be partaker of it with you." He has actually a word here coming up for what he does. "Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain," or that you may win it. He's in it to win it, is what he's saying. And here it is, verse 25. "And everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things." Now, we look at that word temperate and we think, well, he's moderate in everything he does. He's level-headed about it. And it's just temperance. Temperance, I believe, used to be a word during the when alcohol was outlawed, and it was the temperance movement, which meant you're not going to drink much alcohol. But this, it really means a lot more than that. In the NIV, it says that he is in strict training. He's preparing himself. It's more than just not doing anything. It's also taking the positive step of doing something. He is in strict training for the future, for the opportunity, or for his shot. When he gets that shot, he wants to be prepared. That's why he is temperate, or that's why he's in strict training, to get himself prepared for the time when it comes up so that he doesn't fall short. "Everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown. Therefore, I run thus, not with uncertainty. Thus I fight, not as one," and here's another reference to, this one's to boxing, "not as one who beats the air, but I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified." So he takes the time to prepare for what's coming up and prepare for what he is doing. And that's what Esther did. That's what these girls here did. The girls in the back there on our team, they got prepared for that shot. They got prepared to run that particular play. They had a design for it, and it was teamwork, but each individual had to be prepared, and they had to prepare themselves so that when that time came, when it came time for them to execute that one thing, that they could do it, and because they could do it, they were able to win the game. Going back to the book of Esther, and if you had difficulty finding it, it's the book before Job, which is before Psalms. It's after Ezra and Nehemiah. going back in the very first chapter, this relates to the Jews in the Persian Empire. It says the Jews were taken from Jerusalem in several stages. But if you remember, this is where Daniel came from. He went to Babylon, and then after the Chaldeans or the Babylonians had conquered them and deported them, taken them, they had killed some, they had deported some, and so on and so forth. Daniel went in this particular at one of those stages, but after the Chaldeans, the Medes came over, took over the Chaldeans, and they were then under the control of the Chaldeans. But they weren't back in Jerusalem. They were in the vast empire of the Persian Empire, which stretched all the way from India to Ethiopia. It says here, and it came to pass in verse 1 of Esther, in the days of Ahasuerus. This was the Ahasuerus who reigned over 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. So it was quite an empire and quite a large area, and there were Jews dispersed throughout a large portion of the empire. Maybe not everywhere, but in certain sections of it, they were probably somewhat thickly settled. It's also the history of the holiday or festival of Purim that the Jews celebrate in around in sometime in early stages of March. It may sometimes fall in, depends on the calendar year, may sometimes fall in another month a little bit, possibly at the end of February, or I don't know if it ever stretches into April, but it's usually in the first portion of March, generally speaking. And if you've done any study into the Festival of Purim, this is sort of where it comes from. You can probably get most of your information from the book of Esther. Now, Esther is a fairly, in the world and life of commentaries and commentators and people who study these kind of things, it's a fairly controversial book. Esther is one of only two books in, certainly the Old Testament. I don't think there's any in the New Testament, but it's one of the two books that does not mention God. It doesn't mention the name of God, but it's certainly implied at points and places, but it does not mention. The other one, I think, is Song of Solomon. That does not mention God specifically. And for that reason, and what happens throughout it, it's controversial. Different people have different beliefs about Esther, the book of Esther, and what it all means and so forth. But we're not getting into that necessarily, just into the story a little bit. But there was anti-Semitism, which is basically the hatred of those people who are Hebrews or the Hebrew language. Mostly it means against the Jews, but it stems from the offspring of Shem, I think, is where anti-Semitism comes from. And it was rampant in these days. A lot of people, as they have all down through the ages, and it was basically, it had to do with wherever Satan saw a little bit of light coming from anybody, that's where he attacked. And the Jewish people, they knew the Sabbath, kept Sabbath, and they were they had the oracles, as Paul mentions, of God. So they were going to be a target. And they certainly were here. Anti-Semitism was out of control in this particular book and at this particular time. Now, we've already read some of the king, but I think the king's name was actually Xerxes at this time. But the queen's name at that point, when we enter the story here, her name was Vashti, and that's in 1 verse 12. Queen Vashti is maybe one of the first places. Now it's listed in several verses, but at any rate, Queen Vashti, what was happening, the king Xerxes had made a celebration, and it was probably sort of a drunken, debaucherous celebration that he had going on, and it was for a lengthy period of time. And he had then called, during a week of drunkenness, after that he called for Queen Vashti, who also was having a party, and he called for her to come, and he wanted to parade her beauty amongst all the people, because he had all the kings from his different vast empire, all the rulers that come in and so forth. So he wanted to parade her in front of all these and show them what a beautiful queen she was and all that. But she refused to come, which set up where Esther comes in. She refused to come, so they deposed the queen because they were afraid that if this went unpunished and they allowed this to go on, the rest of the empire would hear about it, and all the women in the empire would disobey their husbands. And they couldn't abide that thought, so they decided to take action, and the suggestion was, well, why don't we depose her, and then we'll bring some beautiful young ladies in from all over the kingdom, your vast empire, and we'll present them, and then the one you like, or there were probably like a beauty contest where they judged the different gals or the different ladies, and they would decide on which one to pick, which is what happened here. In chapter 2 of Esther, verse 2, it mentions this, that let the beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. And we'll read on down to verse 4. And let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan, the citadel, which was the royal palace, into the women's quarters, under the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, which he was the one who was in charge of those types of things, and we'll mention him a little further on. Let beauty be preparations be given them, all these young women. Then let the woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This thing pleased the king, and he did so. So they're figuring this all out. They're getting this all arranged and getting this all set up, and they drew a bunch of they went out and they found the most beautiful girls in the whole kingdom and brought them in. And in that dragnet, so to speak, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai. Now, he was the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish. He was a Benjamite. Kish, in chapter 1, was mentioned as having been, and that was his great-grandfather, was mentioned as having been brought to the Persian Empire at the time when Jerusalem was overthrown and all the captives had been brought, or ones that they had captured were brought to the Persian Empire. He had been caught up in that. So let's read verse 6. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, which means myrtle, but that's Esther's name. That is Esther, his uncle's daughter. As I mentioned, his uncle, here it says uncle, but some people feel that it was probably his niece, or at the very least his cousin. For she had neither father nor mother. Now the young woman was lovely and beautiful. Now this, when you look at these words and you do a little bit of a deeper look at it and mine down, drill down a little bit deeper, you'll find that lovely and beautiful, yeah, she was very, very beautiful to behold. She was a very good-looking young lady. But she was also lovely in the sense that she was very personable. She had a very good personality, and she was very likable. She was very pleasant, and people She made a great impression, and that's it goes beyond just the physical beauty, because we, as you remember, the saying is that beauty is only skin deep, because we've probably known in the past maybe people who were handsome or beautiful, but maybe because of their personality and attitude, they weren't so beautiful after you got to know them. And that happens, and we've probably all known those kind of people. But when her father and mother died, in verse 7, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So he raised her, and he must have done quite a job because she was lovely and beautiful. The one part of it, the personality, the pleasing personality, must have been reflected on Mordecai, and I don't know if he had a wife or not, but probably, and probably maybe a family of his own as well, and they probably did a very good job of training up this young girl. So it was, let's see where we're at here, when her father and mother, yeah. So it was when the king's command and decree were heard, and when many young women were gathered at the royal palace under the custody of Haggai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace into the care of Haggai, the custodian of the women. So he was some kind of an overseer. Now the young woman pleased him, and she obtained his favor, so he readily gave beauty preparations to her besides her allowance. In other words, he went above and beyond, and he gave her special additional extra treatment so that she could be prepared to go before the king. And they, in verse 12, you'll see that they did that, and then let's look at verse 10. It says, Esther had not revealed her people. In other words, they did not know that she was Jewish. They thought she was just one of the other people in the empire. Didn't know she was Jewish. So anti-Semitism didn't extend to her because they didn't know she was a Semite. So anyway, in verse 12, each young woman's turn came to go into the king after she had completed 12 months of preparation. Now, she was not only beautiful and very pleasant, but she prepared herself. She did like these other young girls did with basketball. She prepared herself for a whole year, for 12 months. She prepared herself to get ready to be presented before the king. That was her shot. That was where she was going to come in and be able to make a difference. Or that was the time when she had that one opportunity to become the queen, which was quite an honor. Then in verse 17, the king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. So she became all that to say that she did what she had to do, and she prepared herself, and she became the queen. She had prepared herself for that shot. She had that gift of beauty and loveliness. Just like this point guard had the gift of hand-eye coordination, and she could both dribble the ball and shoot with tremendous accuracy, and in her case, it won the game. And, of course, so here she was, and then Mordecai said in verse 14 of chapter 4, who knows whether you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this. But there's more happening and more going on here. In chapter 3, beginning in verse 8, Mordecai had fallen out of favor with this one person called Haman, who was an evil anti-Semite in this kingdom. Verse 8 of chapter 3, he had a vendetta against Mordecai, and not only against Mordecai, but also against the whole Jewish race. Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people, scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other people's, and they do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. So he's finding a crack, a chink in the armor, if you will, and he's going to go after Mordecai and his people. Now, this possibly could have even had an impact on Jesus Christ, because Jesus Christ, as we remember, was Jewish, and if he had killed all the people in the empire, then maybe his line of succession could have been some of those. At any rate, if it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work to bring it into the king's treasures. Now, what he's saying, we'll kill all these people and we'll confiscate their property. And they have a lot of property. They probably were fairly wealthy as those things go in that particular empire and in that particular at that particular time. So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman. Now that's the same as his seal of approval. If we get something officially done, an official document for the state, it has to have the king, or it has to have the government seal of approval on it. They have a seal that they use to stamp it with, and then you can see that, and that's what they were doing here. The king's signet was that same thing. They gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. He was the enemy of the Jews. Now, it did say that they were from the tribe of Benjamin, but Benjamin and Jews in those days were basically pretty much the same because they were all living, they were in part of Judah. But at any rate, so he was the enemy of the Jews, and the king said, you can annihilate them. It's been tried since then too, several times. The latest one we know was in the Holocaust when they were all herded up together and sent in railway boxcars and by other means to the concentration camps, the death camps, and were gassed and killed in whatever manner that the Hitler wanted to do that. And so this is nothing new. It's been going on since the time there were Jews. So this went out, and this is why Esther had come to the kingdom, as Mordecai said. Maybe this is your shot. Maybe this is why you are here. And she had indeed affected the outcome of this. Now, we won't go through the rest of it. Let's just say that Haman's proverb says, he who digs a pit is going to fall in it himself, and Haman had made gallows and was going to hang Mordecai. Ends up he got hung on the gallows that he built for Mordecai, and the Jews were saved, and so forth, if you read the rest of the book of Esther. So it's not, it was, she did perform when she was called upon. She was brave because she went into the king. The king would only, if somebody came in called for. In other words, if the king didn't call for somebody, and somebody came in to the king uncalled, they could be executed. And she took that chance. She said, well, "I mentioned that God is not specifically referred to, but He is. There is a background or backdrop of God in this book. In verse 16." Esther called for a fast of all the Jews, neither eat nor drink, fast for me for 3 days. Well, if there was no God, fasting was a godly thing, basically to call on God's favor and to be closer to God. So if there was no God, there was really no need to fast, or there was really no point in fasting. It was all in vain, and it was all, excuse me, for nothing. But they called the fast, and what she had asked for happened. She was spared. She was found to be in favor with the king, and then it turned into good for her and for the whole country, or for the whole group of Jews that were in the Persian Empire at that time. We all, just like she did, just like this point guard did, we all have our own gifts as well. Maybe we're not all as beautiful as she was or as lovely as she was, personality or whatever, or maybe we're not as talented physically and athletically as this point guard was, but we do all have gifts, and we're told about that. And we'll turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 12 to look at this. Now, in chapter 12 of 1 Corinthians, it talks about spiritual gifts. And it's ironic, or I don't think it's ironic. I think it's deliberate, and I think it's on purpose. In chapter 11, it talks, and up to chapter 11 of 1 Corinthians, it talks about the days of unleavened bread and the Passover season and so forth. Well, in chapter 12, it talks about the Spirit and spiritual gifts, which what's the next feast coming up? The day of Pentecost, or the Feast of Weeks, is coming up, which is, as we've come to understand and know, it's about the Spirit, and it's about spiritual things and God's Spirit being poured out on His people, on those who He has called. So chapter 12 talks about the Spirit and spiritual things, and ironically enough, or again, probably not ironic, it's probably deliberate, in chapter 15, it talks about the resurrection, which is the final fall Holy Day season. So it's all basically somewhat outlined in 1 Corinthians. But in chapter 12 of 1 Corinthians, verse 1, "Now concerning spiritual gifts, brethren, I do not want you to be ignorant." Spiritual gifts. "There are," verse 4, "there are diversities of gifts, but the same Spirit." In other words, all of us have gifts. Verse 7 says, "The manifestation of the Spirit is given to each one for the profit of all." Then dropping on down to verse 11, "But one and the same Spirit works all these things, distributing to each one individually as He wills." So we all have spiritual gifts. In verse 18, "But now God has set the members, each one of them in the body, just as He pleased." We all have gifts. And guess what? We all probably should work on those gifts and enhance those gifts so that we can make the most use of those gifts that God has given us. Remember the talents? He expects us to advance those gifts that we have. We've talked here occasionally, a number of people have mentioned John Maxwell, who is a motivational and leadership training leader that does seminars on leadership and so forth. And he brought up an interesting point. He said that we can take talents. Let's say we have a 2 on the 1 to 10 scale. We have talent of 2 in one area. In running, I may be 0, as Paul said, or maybe minus 0. I can sometimes barely walk, let alone run. But at any rate, we may have a 2 on a gift, the gift meter in one area. And he said we can work probably as hard as we want. We can't advance that all that much. We can maybe get it up to a 3 or a 4. But he said we might have a 6 on the talent meter in something else. And if we enjoy it, and that's a gift that we have, we can maybe advance that to 8 or 9 or even 10 by working at it hard, working on our gifts. I'm just going to bring up a couple of things here, a couple of gifts and a couple of possibilities. I'm not going to go through a long list or very much about them. But you can think about these as we go along, because oftentimes we wonder, well, what gift do I have? I know people, and some people are like this. They have the gift of comforting or exhortation or of encouragement. I know when my niece, when we went to the calling hours for my niece and then the funeral, it just seemed like some people were very good at comforting other people. They had that gift. So We in our company where I work, we have a word for the year, and this year the word is encourage. We can work on encouragement or in comforting others. We can work on that every day. We could practice maybe to encourage somebody. If that's our gift, if we think we're good at that, maybe that's something we could do, to work on becoming a better encourager, to become better at it. Or maybe, I'll give you a scripture to write down that you can look at later. 1 Thessalonians 5:11. Or maybe faith is our strength. Maybe we're have strong faith. There again, and you can look at James 1:3 for that. You could write that down. When we fail, it can diminish our faith. It can dilute our faith. Maybe our faith is not as strong. But remember to pick ourselves up, to go on and build on our faith, because faith, as James says in the first chapter, faith, the testing of our faith, produces results. Our faith can and will become stronger by testing us. So if we fail, if everything was easy, we couldn't really have faith. So if it's tested, perhaps it'll get stronger. So when we fail, if we pick ourselves up and go on, it will get stronger. Maybe we're wisdom and we give good advice. Again, and we could go to James 1 and verse 5 if you want to write that down. Maybe we're good at giving good advice. I heard recently that opinions are free, but advice costs. So maybe you're good at giving good advice. Maybe that's your strength. And if you are, there are things you can do to become even wiser and become stronger. James said, if any lack wisdom, let him ask, believing. In other words, let him ask with faith, and God will give it. Another one, teaching. Maybe we are good at teaching others. And a scripture to look at would be Romans 12:7. But maybe we're very good at teaching. But there again, that's something that we can become more skilled at by studying. If we want to teach the Bible, for example, we would need to get up at 5 o'clock if we don't have time in our busy lives to study or to read the Bible as we should. Maybe we'll have to get up like those girls did at 5 o'clock and read the Bible when our mind's clear and when there's not many phone calls do I get at 5 o'clock in the morning. So if I get up at 5 o'clock, I can probably give my undivided attention to learning whatever it is I want to learn for a certain period of time anyway. Or maybe it's leading. Maybe we are naturally good leaders. 1 Timothy 4:12 addresses being a good leader. We can work at being a good example because people naturally follow other people. They naturally follow leaders who are actually doing something or doing what they talk about or saying. People naturally gravitate towards that. And we're admonished in 1 Timothy 4:12 to do that. There are many, many more gifts. Those are just a few gifts that come to mind quickly that we could have. There are all kinds of gifts. If you analyze yourself, you could probably find many more gifts that you have or that people around you have. But again, it takes practice. It takes 1,000 shots to make one. We can prepare for our shot. And it's not just oftentimes one shot. We might have a shot a week. At times, it seems like opportunities come from us from all angles all the time. And other times, not so much, but nonetheless, there are times when we have many opportunities to take that shot, to make that game-winning shot, and have nothing but net. Esther's preparation, she made preparations for meeting the king for a whole year, but she made that her whole life. she was studying to become, or she practiced being a personal and pleasant person and enhancing her beauty in that way her whole life. And Mordecai, I would say, must have been one of those people who helped her to advance in that way. Same thing for the point guard, the gifts that they had, or the gifts that they had on that whole team. They prepared for that whole year because they were disappointed in the year previous. So they practiced harder, they tried harder, and they made the shot when they got it. When their opportunity came, they made it, and they did it. Our gifts are the same way. They can be enhanced, they can be advanced, they can grow if we take a little bit of a look at them and say, hey, you know what, I could learn this, or I could be better at that. And believe me, this is directed at me, because this is the thing I need to do as well. I'm not talking about something that doesn't apply to me. This applies to me, but it applies to everybody all the time. Our gifts can grow, and they should grow, and that's what we're here for. We're heading towards another holy day, the spring holy days, when God's Spirit will be amplified and exemplified. And we're, our job, we're between the Sabbath, the days that lead up to that. Our job is to grow up to that point and beyond, to continually grow. So in conclusion, we won't go back there, but Esther 14 and verse 4 says, who knows he was talking to Esther, if you came to this point, to this kingdom, for this time, for a time such as this, who knows whether we're out there and the person coming along or the person we're talking to is maybe needs that little prod to make that next step towards God's kingdom, and whether we can take that, give them that encouragement, or we can teach them in that way, or maybe we can give them the example of faith that we have, and maybe they can take that next step towards becoming one of God's called and chosen children. But sometimes it just takes a little extra nudge. Who knows whether that's why we came to a certain point? Because we are called to do those things. If we are prepared, when our shot comes, it will be nothing but net.